Is it always clear when circumstances are bad enough to require a man of action, like Nehemiah, to bring about God's will? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author on our continuing series of Ezra and Nehemiah. And today we are going to be focusing specifically on Nehemiah. My conversation partners are Brant Berglund and Dave Thomas, both teachers in the Walla Walla University School of Theology. Now, let me come back to that leading question. Is it clear when you need somebody who breaks all the rules and goes in like a ton of bricks to make things happen?
I think we're always happy when somebody else will stand up and do it. And we can look back and say, wow, that person's timing was great. If it isn't the right time, people usually just say that person made a mess of things. And so I don't think we always know ahead of time. Maybe there are a few visionaries who do, but I'm certainly not one of those.
Yeah, I don't think it's always clear. I think a lot of this is dictated by circumstance. It's like Winston Churchill was not that spectacular a leader until he had to be in the war, and then he was truly magnificent.
Yeah.
I think he surprised a lot of people, and I've seen that in churches. I've seen that in you see it in politics. You see it sometimes in companies. So.
Yeah, they'll say it was the right person for the right time and the right job.
Yeah, so the answer is it's not always clear.
It's not always clear.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good then. Now, there's something very interesting about this man, Nehemiah. He was the king's cupbearer, and it seems remarkable that he was not able to cover his emotions, because when he got word that Jerusalem was in a mess, he was basically morose for 4 months. And the king, instead of beheading him, you know, was apparently sympathetic to him and gave him a mandate. And
so sometimes pouting around and moping around will get you some good action, right?
Apparently it did in Nehemiah's case, yeah.
But it also speaks to the relationship Nehemiah has with King Cyrus,
yes,
here. And I think he was put in the right position for the right time. I don't know that I would have argued that the moping was the right course of action, but it sure got what he wanted.
No, I don't think he was moping on purpose. I think he was just simply downcast.
Heartbroken.
Yeah.
Now, I have a question here, which I don't know whether we can really answer, but to what extent is Nehemiah's prayer a model for us in times of deep distress? Now, his prayer is found in first chapter of his book, 4 to 11. First, he includes himself with the sinners among God's people, verse 6 and 7. Second, he lets the Lord know that he is fully aware of the threatened results of apostasy. But third, he reminds the Lord of the divine promises to restore his people. It's that last one, Lord, you promised.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a model for us today, those three aspects?
Well, I would argue there's also one more in verse 5, and that's admitting, praising God for who he is, that he's a covenant-keeping God. But it does seem, it's not manipulative, maybe that's too much, but saying, God, you promised and we're gonna ask you to remember your covenant just as we're remembering that we're a part of your covenant too. We have a role to play and you have a role to play. That's what a covenant is about.
Yeah, and I'm reminded of the prayer that Moses prayed when God said, I'm going to wipe them all out. And he said, well, wait a minute, you can't do that.
What will the Egyptians say?
Yeah.
You can't do that. You brought all these people out here, and the Egyptians are watching. You can't do that. You know, and at least anthropomorphically speaking, he persuades God not to do that.
Yeah, it's one of the amazing passages where the Lord repented.
Yeah. When I read that, it's almost like he's incredulous. God, you can't do that. You can't do that.
But he is kind of reminding God of his promise. If you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though those of you who have been scattered were in the most remote part of the heavens, I will gather them from there. He's basically saying, this is the promise you made, and we believe we're part of that fulfillment right now. So you do your part of the covenant, we'll do ours. That's what a covenant gives us. Legal and maybe even relational authority.
But see, I don't think that's a bad way for a person to pray.
No, not at all.
I don't think that. I don't really believe God has to be reminded. But, you know, I guess praying that kind of prayer indicates the seriousness with which we are intending to fulfill the covenant that God has made with us.
Well, it's amazing. If you look at the Psalms, there's a lot of reminding going on there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's not unusual to say, hey, you've forgotten, see?
Yeah.
So Now, we have, I want to focus on the contrast here between Ezra and Nehemiah. I've wondered if maybe we could talk about salvation by temperament.
I can hardly wait for this, Alton.
I mean, Nehemiah was just really a heavy-handed guy, and he got stuff done.
Type A choleric.
Type A choleric times 10,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And Ezra was the scholar. Now, we'll come to a couple places in these books where the people took the initiative, which is really quite, it was a lay rebellion, you know, to lead out in spiritual matters, and it was really quite something. Now, let me ask another question.
Well, wait a minute. We're not done talking about those two.
Oh, okay.
I mean, what do you think? I think that in the cause of God, you need all kinds of people. And, you know, sometimes you need the quiet, reflective people. Other times you need to have somebody come in and say, hey, wait a minute, this can't go on anymore. Let's fix it right now, and off we go. See, that they galvanize action that quiet people would never galvanize. And I don't think it's one pitted against the other. I think it's you need both kinds, depending on circumstance. And you happen to see them both in these books.
Well, I think about even our own faculty meetings together when we speak. Some of us, I would admit myself and maybe a couple others, speak more. But those who are more quiet, when they speak, they've always reflected. They're more thoughtful. Then they come up with something that's certainly worth hearing. And it's a good thing that we don't always override them.
Yes. Okay. That reminds me, and I don't know whether she will be listening to this program or not, but Helen Zalber, who has a way, when I was a student here, when she was a member of committee, she would never say much. But when she did speak, everybody just rolled over and played dead, you know. It seems to me that, and
well thought out, always well thought wisdom, out. Words sure. of wisdom, yeah.
So what did you mean by salvation by temperament, Alden?
Well,
are you suggesting some of us are more easily saved than others? Or that there's some merit in certain kinds of temperaments?
I think there is merit in certain kinds of temperaments, but every strength also has its disadvantage.
Yeah.
Every strength is also a weakness. Mm-hmm. And what I see happening here, and if I had to choose between a devout Ezra, who didn't get much done except to study, and an activist, Nehemiah, who would I choose?
Depending on circumstance, if you were on vacation and in a reflective mood, you'd be happy to be with Ezra. But if you wanted to get some emergency taken care of, you'd be following Nehemiah in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
And maybe they're both needed. Maybe there's a reason we have both books and both men, and we have Zerubbabel, and we have Shealtiel, and we have all the others who join as well. But certainly it seems like Nehemiah is the one on whose heart the burden was put to get the final act done to rebuild the place.
And see, there are some people who come into a situation and can see immediately that this is not okay, we got to fix it now, and they galvanize action, and everybody joins in, and mm-hmm. here we go, which is precisely what happens here.
And we would say they're the ones with the gifts of leadership, wouldn't we, usually?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, when I think about Nehemiah calling people to action, the fact that he went in among them and that he threw out that challenge and created the in their minds the possibility of doing this, it becomes a probability and then an actuality. They actually say, oh, let's go do this. And then when stones start being laid and stuff, this thing catches life on its own. And mm-hmm. before you know it, circumstances are very different.
The motivation here is a really, really intriguing. Because, first of all, when he gets there, within 3 days after he arrived in Jerusalem, he goes out by night to see what the situation really is.
Quietly, alone.
Doesn't tell anybody.
Right.
And when he finally comes back, I am intrigued by the way it's stated here in Nehemiah chapter 2. When I said to them, you see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come. Let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we may no longer suffer disgrace. I told them that the hand of my God had been gracious upon me and also the words that the king had spoken to me. Then they said, let us start building.
Mm-hmm. He didn't even tell them what to do specifically. No. He just galvanized them. Yeah. Several fantastic books on leadership, Christian books on leadership, have been written about Nehemiah and from his perspective. And this was one of the arguments that was made in one of the books I have in the forefront of my mind, and that was he did not cast the vision until he was ready to do so. He did not put it out to the people until he had already surveyed the situation. He knew what needed to be done, and then he showed them the condition. The people caught the vision simply by him demonstrating how bad things were.
Good. Now, well, let me come back to that question I never really answered, salvation by temperament. I'm not sure that any of us are ever saved by what we do. But in fact, I think almost all of our initial responses are non-volitional. You know, you don't have Nehemiah sitting back there wondering. He was wired. He was ready to go.
Well, it was obvious what he needed to do in his mind anyway.
Now, one other question. How does Nehemiah's approach to issues and conflicts compare to that of Jesus? Was Jesus more like Ezra, or was he more like Nehemiah, or neither?
Well, when I hear that question, I think of Jesus going into the temple. He didn't go in like Ezra.
That's true.
He went in there, and it says that people fled.
Except for the children.
Yeah.
But the children come running.
Yeah, but the people who were doing wrong fled all, and that means they'd hightailed it out of there. So it wasn't because he looked like a friendly neighbor.
Right.
He went in there to take care of business.
And yet when we most often think about Jesus, we think of him as the meek and lowly Jesus, the quiet. Yeah. And yet when I read the Gospels and I see him traveling from place to place, never getting a moment's peace because the people are always crowding around him, I sense that he had the courage of Ezra, but maybe the scholarly ability of Ezra and the courage of Nehemiah.
And I mean, his is very circumstantial because you say the children came running to him, and then he's all calm again. He's like Ezra, but when the bad guys were in town, Nehemiah showed up.
See, I would love. There's very little. This is one of the places where Jesus gets angry. See, mm-hmm. And the interesting thing of usually when people get angry, the children are the first one that heads for the hill.
Yeah.
But here, when Jesus got angry, the evil people fled, and the children came running. I would love to be angry.
I think
like
he was
that.
Also angry at the tomb of Lazarus.
Yeah, that was, I think, another example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't as obvious and flamboyant, but he was.
There's one other point that I want to bring up here, and this has to do with how Scripture, the text of Scripture, can suggest things which devotional writers take and run with it. And I think here of Ellen White's comment on Ezra and Nehemiah, because both Ezra and Nehemiah had radically different approaches to the leaders. Let me just read you the quotes. Same story, same writer, but notice the two different lessons that she brings. In this matter, Ezra and his companions saw an opportunity to magnify the name of God before the heathen. Faith in the power of the living God would be strengthened if the Israelites themselves should now reveal implicit faith in their divine leader. They therefore determined to put their trust wholly in him. They would ask for no guard of soldiers. They would give the heathen no occasion to ascribe to the strength of man the glory that belongs to God alone. They could not afford to arouse in the minds of their heathen friends one doubt as to the sincerity of their dependence on God as his people. Strength would be gained not through power and influence of idolatrous men, but through the favor of God. Only by keeping the law of the Lord before them and striving to obey it would they be protected. Now, I see that I've overshot the clock here. The other one I won't take time to read, but Nehemiah says, hey, we need help. And they ask the king, and they got all kinds of help.
Mm-hmm.
So on that quick note, we will have to conclude our lessons. I want to thank both of you, and I want to thank Abby Wissink, our program engineer, all of you for listening in. For the Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.